mention before we begin the show this evening, next week, although I, Baruch Hashem, we almost never miss, but for simcha reasons, there will not be a show next week. Have a family wedding. My nephew, Mr. Shem, is getting married on the Lag BaOmer in London, and still have not mastered the art of being in two places at the same time. So next week will be a fulfillment of the Gemara's maxim, Mevatlin Talmud Torah Lachnasas Kala. Mitz Hashem, we will meet again in 2 weeks' time. In the meanwhile, there is plenty to discuss in Parshas Emor, and I would like to invoke the Gemara statement of Ein Mukdam U'Meucher BaTorah, and in so doing begin at the end of the Parsha. It's a section that if we start at the beginning, we never get to. But of course, there's plenty to say. And that is the episode of the Mekalel, of this individual who got into an argument for various reasons. He ended up cursing Hashem's name and blaspheming, and he was put to death. And he is introduced in Perek Kafdalad, Pasuk Yud. And there's quite a number of angles from which to consider his situation and the way the Torah presents the Parsha. The Pasuk Yud reads, Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis, son of an Israelite woman, he went out, who ben Ishmitzri, the son of a Mitzri also, Besoch ben Yisrael, in the midst of ben Yisrael, Vayinosuba Machanen, and there's a machlokas erupts between ben Yisraelis v'Isha Yisraeli, this son of the Israelite woman who we just mentioned, and some other person, an Ish Yisraeli. And Vayikov ben Ish Yisraelis is Hashem Vayikalel, and he ended up cursing Hashem's name. Rashi comments on the opening phrase of Pasuk Yud. And let's see Rashi. Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis. Mehechon Yotza, that's a good shaila. He went out. He left. Where did he leave? Pasuk doesn't say, just says that he left. And as we will see, Rashi, quoting Chazal, has three things to say. And we have to see how they relate to each other. Rabbi Levi Omer, me'olamo yotza. He left his world. And perhaps the simple understanding of what he means to say is that he forfeited his world through his share, maybe his share in the world to come, through this blasphemy. We're not entirely aware that a person who curses Hashem's name and is then put to death for it has lost his share in the world to come. But he left his world. Certainly, he went downhill. Rabbi Brechia Omer, again, we're looking for, and interestingly, just before we move on, me'olamo yotza. It's the most enigmatic of the three explanations. But as Rabbi Nebachia points out, we're looking for context. Vayetze, he left. Where did he leave? Pasuk doesn't say. But if you look at Pasuk Tes, which is about Lechem Haponim, and there's more to say about that in a moment, the final words of Pasuk Tes, Kodesh Kodoshim Hulo, Me'ishi Hashem, Chok Olam. Now, of course, the word Chok Olam, Olam there means an everlasting chok, an everlasting statute or law. However, in terms of the Medrash, the word Olam featuring just before the word Vayetze already gives us the basis for that comment that he left Olamo. Chok Olam Vayetze, Me'olamo Yotza. The second comment, Rabbi Brachia Omer, Miparsha Shalamala Yotza. Again, if context will guide us and we want to know where he went out from, and the Pasuk doesn't say, however, look at what has been discussed in the above psukim, and that is Lechem Haponim, the last two or three psukim. Ligleg va'omar. He scoffed, he mocked, and said, Yom HaShabbos Yarchenu, if they place the bread on the Shulchan on Shabbos and don't eat it till the next Shabbos, that seems, he said jokingly, that seems not b'chavdik. Derech HaMelech le'echol paschama b'chol yom. It's the way of the king to eat warm bread every day. Shema pastzonenes shel tisha yomim b'tmiya. Does he eat cold bread? And not only cold bread, stale bread. That's 9 days old. He felt that was a bizoyan. But of course, he wasn't saying it out of for covet of Hashem. He was saying it just to make a bit of a joke of the whole thing. Ironically, we happen to know something about the Lechem Haponim, which is referred to in the Pasuk in Shmuel. Sha'cham b'yom hilakcho. It actually stayed warm and fresh, al derech neis, the entire 9 days. That's a bit of a tragedy of this Mekalel. He made a joke. He didn't realize that it was actually true. In other words, if he'd only waited and to see what happens a week later, he would have seen that actually it does remain cham. So his concerns, quote unquote, would have been taken care of. But nonetheless, people who make jokes tend not to have that much patience. They like to zrizim makdimim, to get them in at the earliest opportunity. That became his undoing. So that's the second approach. He left, his point of departure was joking or scoffing about Lechem upon him, the previously mentioned parsha. Umasnisa amra, but there's another interpretation or understanding where he left from. Mi beis dino shel Moshe yotza mechuyav. He left having lost a din Torah. People who lose din a Torah can sometimes react rather extremely. What was the din Torah about? Ba lita ohalo besoch machanet, is encamping, finding their place. And here he is. He wants to encamp also in the camp of Dan. Amar lo mativcha lekan. So they said to him, what are you doing here? Amar lehem mipnei Dan ani. I belong to Dan. Amar lo isha digla beosos. The digolim and people's positioning in their camps is stated vis-a-vis their father's lineage. And the point is, his father wasn't Jewish. His father was the Mitzri, of which we will speak in a moment. And therefore he was rejected. Nichnas lebeis dinu shel Moshe v'yotza mechuyov. He left having lost his case. Amad v'kidef. So he began to blaspheme. So these, and just to summarize, because we've read a bit, the three comments of Rashi on the word vayetze, either yotza me'olamo, or yotza from the parsha of Lechem Aponim, or yotza from the Beis Din of Moshe having lost his case. And Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, that's all, in his Sichos, explains that the relationship of these three comments is actually that the first is a portrayal, and the second two are backgrounds to that. The idea of me'olamo yotza, after all, he made a joke and then he committed a terrible crime, or he lost a case and committed a terrible crime. The question is, how could that happen? It's such an extreme thing to do. He was killed over it in the end. I mean, how does a person come to, in the morning he got up and everything was fine, and then something happened and he did this terrible thing? And Reb Chaim says, this is the concept of me'olamo yotza, a very profound idea, whereby every person has their world, their olam, in the sense that they have their surroundings, their values, they know what's what, things are as they should be, and they therefore, within that world, act and behave accordingly. Should a person ever have something that causes them to lose their equilibrium, very quickly they can descend into things that they perhaps a few moments ago could never have imagined themselves doing, but they're almost in a different place. And without the trappings and without the surroundings that they're used to hold them, in a sense, they almost become like a different person, and things previously unimaginable can happen very quickly. We find, for example, he explains, at least to be Melamed Zchus, when Bnei Yisrael, who took a terrible turn when they made the Egel, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened as a product of confusion. They're used to Moshe being there. That's what they rely on it, and it keeps them in place and keeps them in check, and everything is as it should be. As soon as they see the notion that Moshe is not coming back, in a moment of confusion, you can lose your equilibrium. And when you do that, you lose your world. You lose your bearings. A person who loses his bearings can take a very wrong decision. And therefore, if the question is, having expressed generally may Olama Yotso, then the question is, what happened to take him out of his world? Something perhaps itself extreme. And the answer to that is either the extreme disappointment, he was shattered by the fact that he would not be able to take his place in Machane Dan. He was hoping for it, and he's all of a sudden he's been excluded. He finds himself in an unexpected place. And within that, in unfamiliar settings, so to speak, atmospherically, he was able to commit such a crime. The alternative is he began to mock the Lechem Haponim, which is the other, as if to say, really a person's world is the product of their values. As soon as a person pokes a joke at something that's actually important, all of a sudden, other things which were previously important, it's difficult to, it's a slippery scale, slippery slope. And therefore, what began with a joke about lechem aponim, so that it's very quickly can rapidly deteriorate into anything as possible at that stage. That's the importance of a person preserving their olam. So these are comments with regards to Rashi's words of what vayetze means. And of course, the guiding question is, the pasuk doesn't say where he left, and therefore it leaves it for us to say that, to try and fathom it. However, the Ramban, who often will quote Rashi, but sometimes feels that perhaps Rashi went beyond what the pshat requires, and he may then offer something more simple reading of the pasuk. You see, says Ramban, if you read the pasuk, keep going. Vayetze ben isha Yisraelitz, behu ben ish mitzri, besoch ben Yisrael. As if you just keep reading until the words besoch ben Yisrael, so then you'll understand that the pshat is really vayetze besoch ben Yisrael. That's all one unit. As if to say, the word vayetze by itself, if you take it by itself, you'll be left with a question. Doesn't say where he went from. However, as soon as you reach that second phrase, besoch b'nei Yisrael, so then the meaning very simply is, he went out from his own private domain or whatever into the broader domain of b'nei Yisrael. And that, says Ramban, is something that has echoes elsewhere. For example, in Megillat Esther, you find exactly those words. Beginning of Perek Dalet, which we looked at this year. Mordechai yada'as kol asher nasa. Vayetze besoch ha'ir. Vayetze besoch ha'ir means he left his home or he left wherever and went out into the broader city. So you see that one doesn't always need to say vayetze from where. As long as he's going to a place broader than previously, that's a self-contained phrase and the parshanut is settled. And therefore Ramban contends, similarly here, one doesn't really need al derech ha'pshat to address the word vayetze and ask, where did he leave from? Keep reading, you'll get to the word besoch b'nei Yisrael, and put it together. Vayetze, besoch b'nei Yisrael, he left his house, or his tent, or whatever, besoch b'nei Yisrael. So it's a very interesting example of something Ramban does often, as if to say, not only is he arguing with Rashi as to what the pshat is, but where one needs to look. Is there even a pshat concern here, or is it all more or less a result? However, Rashi did comment. And the reason why Rashi commented is because, as explained by the Peirush Shem Olam, which is a Peirush on the Toras Kohanim, Rashi feels that you cannot say in this pasuk what the Megillah says, Vayetze Besoch Ha'ir, for a simple reason. In Megillah, Vayetze Besoch Ha'ir, all the words are together. And therefore, Vayetze Besoch Ha'ir, the word Besoch Ha'ir immediately followed the word Vayetze. They therefore qualify it, and that's okay. But here, says Rashi, I'm not prepared to ignore all the other words that are in between. Because if we look again, Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis, Vehu ben Ish Mitzrim, and that's a lot of information. We're in the middle of a phrase here. You can't just interrupt and start telling me his whole family history. Say that somewhere else. But if the word Besoch Yisrael, Besoch b'nei Yisrael, are meant to qualify the word Vayetze, so put them together and then tell me his father was an Ish Mitzri in a minute's time. And therefore, Bimation, Rashi is inclined to see that the word Vayetze is actually distinct from the words B'nai Yisrael, and therefore it needs its own resolution. And thus Rashi asked, Vayetze, where did he leave? And in come three Pirushim. Now what's interesting is, this machloka, so to speak, between Rashi and Ramban, as to whether the words Vayetze is distinct from Besoch B'nai Yisrael, will beget another dispute. Because if you see Vayetze as being distinct, which Rashi does, you will also see the words Besoch B'nai Yisrael as being distinct, and they will also need their own commentary. And let us see what Rashi says on the words Besoch B'nai Yisrael. They're their own message. And Rashi says, Melamed Shenis Gayer. This teaches us that he converted. And once again, to understand that for Rashi, the words Besoch B'nai Yisrael, they stand by themselves, they need to be interpreted by themselves. And what is the background? As Rashi tells us on the words Ben Ish Mitzri, Hu HaMitzri Sheharag Moshe. I mean, there's a very specific Egyptian man that was his father that we know about. This takes us back to Parshas Shemos. Moshe comes out and he sees Ish Mitzri hitting, that is to say, beating to death Ish Ivri. And the background to this, as Rashi tells us from Chazal, I mean, why does he have such a vendetta with this Ish Ivri beating him to death? Because he was just with his wife. He took a liking to this Ivri's wife. He slept him out of bed before dawn in the morning. He then entered and she thought that it was him. The husband came back, the actual husband, and saw, and the Mitzri was kind of found out, and his response was to try and kill this Ivri. But the product of that union was this child. That's what it means, that he was Ben Ish Mitzri. That Ish Mitzri was actually his father. There is a bit of an irony, actually, because the Pasuk says that Moshe killed that Mitzri. And just before he killed him, it says, Vayarki Ein Ish. He saw there was no man. And Rashi explains, it doesn't mean Kipshuto, he saw that no one was there. Because people were there. Right? Dasan and Aviram the next day were about to tell on him. So the people were there. But Vayarki Ein Ish means he saw that no person of worth, no one would ever be misgayer from him in the future. The irony is, one of his children was misgayer, but that was already the product of the union that had just happened. So it was just 5 minutes too late. And from this point onwards, there's no one else. And Moshe killed him. And therefore, because his father was Mitzri, that's the background to Rashi saying, Besoch B'nai Yisrael, and this is from the Teras Kohanim, Melamed Shenis Gayer. He converted. And there is a major question in understanding the intent of the Teras Kohanim when it says Nisgayer, he converted. What's the background to that question? Really, it comes to discuss the status of what we call the Jewish people prior to Matan Torah. I mean, what are they? We know that in time they will become Am Yisrael with all that goes with that. The question is, when did that happen? And it's a question that begins already from the time of the Avos. It's a very interesting way to ask the question. If you would ever ask someone, you know, was Avram Avinu Jewish, they might look at you as if you never read the Chumash, because he's the first Jew. But it's not so simple, because it could be that what we call Yisrael in that full halachic sense of the word is a product of Matan Torah, of Mamad Har Sinai. Prior to that, we are pre-Jewish. The others are the forerunners. They're preparing the Jewish people, the Shaila. And this question became the subject of a machlokas between Rishonim, and it even goes further back than that, as we will see. The Ramban quotes rabbis that he calls the Tsarfatim. The Tsarfatim, the French rabbis, which is the way that the Sephardim would refer to the Baalei HaTosfos. And he quotes the Baalei HaTosfos, who say that prior to Matan Torah, the rules that govern Judaism didn't yet apply even to what we refer to as the Jewish people. And a corollary of that is the question is, I mean, there is an idea of national identity, but sometimes the mother and the father don't share the same national identity. So then the question is, whose identities does the child assume? And the Chachmei Tzarfat are of the opinion that prior to Matan Torah, the rules were the same as they are for all other nations of the world. For other nations of the world, and we need to know the identity of other nations of the world, because, for example, there are certain rules that apply to an Ammoni, or a Moavi, or a Mitzri, and what if the mother's an Ammoni, and the father's a Moavi, or etc. and so forth, you need to know. And the halacha is, it always follows the father. With the nations of the world, national identity follows the father. And according to Chachmei Tzarfat, the same was true for the Jewish people prior to Matan Torah. That means, as we know, the halacha is that if the mother's Jewish and the father's not Jewish, that the child is fully Jewish. I mean, that's the halacha as we have it. However, says the Chachmei Tzarfat, that all of that is a product of Matan Torah, when we fully assumed Din Yisrael. But prior to that, it actually followed the father for us as well, for the nation that would become the Jewish people. And a corollary of that is, in the case of this particular individual whose father was a Mitzri, whose mother was Jewish, he was not Jewish. However, at a certain point, he decided to become Jewish, which of course he's entitled to do. And he did. And that's what the Torah's Kohanim means when it says, Melamed Shinis Geir. It was actual Geirus to join the Jewish people. He was not naturally part of the Jewish people, whatever their status was. So say the Chachmei Tzarfat. However, Ramban takes issue with them. Ramban is of the opinion that from a certain point, Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they all have full Din Yisrael, with everything that goes with that. In the estimation, understanding of Ramban, from the time that Avram entered the Bris, which is already the beginning, that, you know, that forming that relationship with Hashem, at the end of Lech Lecha, he already has full Din Yisrael. And his proof, actually, is from the Gemara. There is a very interesting comment on the Gemara. It said something about Esav you'd never imagine the Gemara would say. As far as we're concerned, Esav is the archetypical non-Jew. Well, the Gemara says in Kiddushin Daf Yud Ches, discussing the halachas of Yerusha, of inheritance. And the Gemara states that the Torah recognizes the idea of inheritance from father to son, even for Gentiles. That's important to know. It's not Hefker, but if a Gentile passes away, his estate naturally goes to his son. And it brings a pasuk to demonstrate this. The pasuk says in Devarim that Hashem gave Har Seir as a Yerusha to Esav. Chila Esav, Nasati Har Seir, Yerusha. So you see that it's recognized as Yerusha, even though the pasuk says Hashem gave it to him, which isn't normally the way we would describe inheritance. Nonetheless, the Gemara says Esav inherited. And then the Gemara has a most fascinating reaction to that. And the Gemara says, you can't bring a raya from Esav. Esav is Jewish. He wasn't a model Jew. The Gemara refers to him as Yisrael Mumar. He's an apostate Jew. But nonetheless, as the Gemara, an apostate Jew could also inherit his father. It doesn't yet tell us about whether an actual Gentile can inherit his father. And in fact, the Gemara keeps on looking. In the end, it finds Lot, because Lot for sure is not Jewish, because his father's Haran, and he also got an inheritance, Ar, the city of Ar, Nasati Livnei Lot, Yerusha. But it's such a striking section of Gemara, because you see that you can't bring Esav as an example of a non-Jew, because his parents were Jewish, and therefore if he inherits, that's because Jews inherit. He didn't have any Jewish children because his wives were a Hittite and all of that. It ended with him. But that's the status, Yisrael Mumar. And therefore, says Ramban, it appears to me, based on that Gemara, that the idea of Kedushas Yisrael and the halachas of Yisrael applied already from the times of the Avos. If that's true, then the question will be, then if the mother is Jewish, then the child should be Jewish. I mean, that's how Jewish halacha works. Halacha for Jews works. And therefore the question will return to this Ben Ish Mitzri. Because if it's really true that even prior to Matan Torah, the halacha in terms of identity is as we have it, and it follows the mother was Jewish. If the mother was Jewish, he didn't need to convert. So what does it mean when it says Melamed Shenes Gair? And therefore Ramban explains that these words are not meant halachically Geirus in terms of transferring from non-Jew to being Jewish, but rather they're to be taken in a more behavioral sense, as if to say he could very, very easily have just grown up and been like his father and followed his way and stayed in Mitzrayim or whatever, but he didn't. He threw his lot in with the Jewish people. Melamech in Isgar means not only was he halachically Jewish, which he was anyway, but he chose to really identify with the Jewish people. So that is a major discussion, and in fact it relates also to other matters, because as much as the Gemara says in Kiddushin, Daf Yud-Ches, that Esav was Jewish, I mean, with a lot to be desired, but the Gemara elsewhere actually learns halachas of Geirus, of how to convert to Judaism, from Matan Torah, from the process the entire Jewish people went through at Matan Torah. Indeed, it's one of the classic reasons why we read Megillas Rus on Shavuos. Rus is the story of Geirus, of joining the Jewish people. Rus was an individual who joined the Jewish people. We read it on Shavuos because on Shavuos, the entire Jewish people joined the Jewish people. I mean, that's when they became Jewish in the full sense of the word. So clearly there are major messages that would need to be resolved in terms of our status pre-Matan Torah or post-Matan Torah. So that is an important discussion which is hosted by the Ramban between himself and the Chachmei Tzarfat. But there is an additional possibility here. You see, both sides of the discussion, whether it's Chachmei Tzarfat, or whether it's Ramban, whether he formally converted, or whether he just chose to follow the Jewish people, they're both assuming one thing. And that is that he knew that his father wasn't Jewish. The question is, now what? Does he need a formal conversion? Does he not? But he needs to make a decision who to follow. But we do see, as much as they dispute on that very important point, but they do concur that he was aware of his background. However, I saw today, quoted in the Maskil Adavit, that the Zohar Kodesh says that prior to this episode, he had no idea who his father was. It only came out because he put in for a place in Machane Dan, and then someone had to take him to the side and tell him. In other words, when you think about it, should we ask the question, who would tell him and why? Well, who knew, actually? As if to say, that union happened in just before dawn. That one who found out was the Ish Ivri, the husband of Shlomo Bas Divri. Who else knew? Well, the Mitzri knew, but he didn't last that long. Moshe knew, right? Vayifen Kovacho, right? He saw exactly what had happened. How does Moshe know? Because he's Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's it. No one else knows. Shlomo Bas Divri found out as well, the mother. So it's very easy to appreciate that that means that his actual father died before he was born. So his mother bears him. It's really up to them. Are they ever going to tell him at a certain point this terrible thing that happened, or will they not? And there's ample room to understand why they wouldn't. Just leave him be. And he'll grow up thinking that this Ish Ivri, the husband of Shlomo Bas Divri, is his father. But it all came out at that time. Because when he says, I belong to Machane Dan, the truth is that he didn't. And that's when he found out. And interestingly, this possibility, again, so different from the first approach, was intuited by Rabbeinu Bachya. He doesn't quote the Zohar, but he says, V'yitachen. It could be that he didn't know. He literally woke up that morning thinking he was Jewish, as he did from every morning prior to that point. And then he got a big surprise. And that's what threw him off. That's what really rocked him so much. And in fact, as Ibn Rabachya, this may explain to us something else. How does he respond? He gets into an argument. I mean, someone in that state is liable to get into an argument. And it's because money in it, so that's for sure going to be an argument. And it's nachala. And he gets into an argument, and how does he react? He curses Hashem's name. Now we take it for granted because the pasuk says it, and that's what happened. But when you think about it, that's a very perhaps non-intuitive response to being in an argument, as if to say, if you want to curse the person you're arguing with, that's one thing. But it's such a randomly seeming thing to do. I mean, why would he think to curse Hashem's name? Where did the idea come from? So Rabbi Nebuchadnezzar says he had just found out the story of how he was born, which involved the Mitzri being with his mother, taking his father away. And then now this Mitzri is really, the Mitzri is really his father. No, where's his father now? Moshe killed him. How did he kill him? He killed him with the Shema Mephorash. As Dosan and Aviram say, Hala Hargeni Ata Omer, are you going to speak to kill me? Because that's how he killed the Mitzri. And it was known. Which means that he's, of all the concepts that are swimming around in his head at this very unstable time, he's just heard that Moshe killed his father with a Shema Mephorash. And that's why it's in his consciousness. It's on his horizon, or on his dashboard. And as he reacts badly, he reaches out for the thing that was most recently discussed, which is the Shema Mephorash, and that's what he curses. So I think, according to this approach, perhaps we can even better understand why we say Me Olamo Yotza. He was completely thrown from his equilibrium. This is not just quote unquote an issue of deep disappointment over not getting a Nachala. He should have known it was coming, but it's disappointing to find out. He literally found out today that for his entire life he thought he was Jewish, and he wasn't. And therefore everything kind of fell into disarray. So it was not so much an issue of disappointment, it's an issue of shock or trauma. And there is a further point, which I think is fair to mention, although we have to do so delicately. The Or HaChaim HaKadosh notes that throughout this parsha, we never find out the name of this person, this Mekalel. We find out his mother's name, that gives us the background, his name. Isn't that pertinent information? I mean, there's a parsha in the Torah about him. So why would the Torah not tell us his name? And the Or HaChaim HaKadosh says a Yisod. And that is, when the Torah speaks in criticism of someone or presents a negative episode about someone, it measures the extent to which this person should be negatively portrayed. As if to say, I mean, this is him. This is him in our history. This is him in the Torah. And it makes a big difference if he's mentioned by name or not. To mention him by name, now his name is known as the one who did. If he's not mentioned by name, he's anonymous. Whoever he is, he did a terrible thing and he paid for it. But the Torah stops short of mentioning his name, which is further condemnation. So it's very interesting because it gives us insight. The same is true, by the way, of the Mekoshesh in Parshas Shelach, the one who was gathering the whatever in the Midbar. The Torah doesn't say who he was. We possibly know. Some people were criticized for even saying who he was, as the Gemara tells us, but the Torah doesn't say, and here the Torah doesn't say. It makes a difference. There's a reason why the Torah doesn't say. It's holding back. There's some type of, perhaps, not less than full condemnation. And if we may suggest, again, nothing is done to condone what he did. If he was killed over it, that means he paid for it. But the Torah doesn't mention him by name, and perhaps it's in somehow of recognition that there was a great deal of traumatic background that led him to that. It doesn't make it the right decision. It was the wrong decision, absolutely. But nonetheless, the Torah protects his anonymity in that way. So that's a very interesting further angle, so to speak, to the Mekalel, the very basic question, at what point really was it that he found out about his background? Did he know all along, or was it really something that mamash came out that day? It changes, I think, the way we look at the whole parsha. Now, they put him in a mishmar, they put him in holding, and they wanted to find out what was to happen to him. And it seemingly, therefore, they didn't know. Okay, not all of the halakhas had been transmitted. The Gemara actually says that when he was killed, it's what's called a hora'as sha'a. It was a measure for that time, a contingency measure. Now, What's interesting is there is a concept of hora asha'a, where we have situations like that. It's very unusual, it's atypical, it's just for that particular situation. It was done al pi hadibur. The question is here, it's a very interesting hora asha'a, contingency response, because it happens to be the halachic response. As if to say, in the incoming psukim, the Torah will say, anyone who blasphemes Hashem's name is going to be put to death. So when they put him to death, it's not a usual, so to speak, unusual situation. It's not a usual harash shah. Harash shah is the halacha isn't normally like this, but in this case it is. The halacha is normally like this. So why did the Gemara call it a harash shah? And it just should be call it hurrah. It's just the halacha. That question is raised by the Perush Yad Ramah with a hey, Rabbeinu Meir Halevi Abu Lafia, one of the great Rishonim, and his Perush Yad Ramah on Sanhedrin. How can you discuss a psak which is normal and call it exceptional? What was exceptional about it? Well, says the Yad Ramah, the halacha is that in order for a person ever to receive capital punishment, he needs to be warned about it beforehand. That's called hasra'ah. And if he isn't, then the best and don't kill him. Now, because the halacha wasn't known, even though it came out very shortly afterwards, it's very, very clear that he did not receive hasra. And under normal conditions, even though he did something that if everyone knew, and had he been warned, he would have been killed, but given that he wasn't warned, he shouldn't have been killed. And therefore, we say it's a hara asha that he should be put to death, even though formal warning that hasra. That's the hara asha. So the question is, well, if that's the harash shah, then what exactly is this special ruling? I mean, what's the measure? And the Radvaz discusses this, Rabbeinu David ben Zamra, one of the late Rishonim, and he explains that it wasn't just, he shouldn't really be killed, but Shamayim is saying, but he is anyway. But rather, says Radvaz, we need to ponder or to probe, what is the role of Hasra? What is the role of the warning? The reason why you need to formally warn a person before they do something terrible for which they could receive a great punishment, is because otherwise you never really know if they have criminal intent, if they really intend to do it, notwithstanding, you can never know. It's to distinguish, in the words of the Gemara, lahavkin ben shogig lemezid, to know who is intentional, who is unintentional. Maybe he just doesn't know. You've got to tell him, you've got to make sure he knows. If that's true, then what HaKadosh Baruch Hu was telling Moshe to kill him anyway wasn't just that he shouldn't really be put to death, but I'm saying to do so as a contingency measure. But rather Hashem is saying, you would never know if he had full criminal intent. For that you'd need Hasra'ah. But I know, and I'm telling you, he did. And therefore, Hasra'ah, in a sense, was compensated for by a direct message from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that what Hasra'ah, that warning, is meant to accomplish or to reveal, was known. And therefore told to Moshe. But this is an interesting situation because it is a special ruling, because normally the Beis Din cannot operate based on executive messages from HaKadosh Baruch Hu about the situation. That's actually objectionable. We have a concept which is called Lo Bashamayim Hi, whereby the Beis Din needs to operate in terms of what it knows and what it has at its disposal. It can't take recourse to sending messages and receiving messages about filling in the gaps, so to speak. So it is a harash shah. It was unusual. But why was it acceptable? So Reuven Margolius says a very interesting thing in his Perush Margolius Sayyam to Sanhedrin. And that is, it could be that the idea that is so well known to us of Lo Bashamayim Hi, that you can't ask heaven for the answer because the Torah has been given, and that's that, it could be that was only true post the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. Because during the entire 40 years in the Midbar, the Torah is continually coming down from Shamayim. So you can't say Lo B'Shamayim Hi until the end. As if to say, we're at the end of the 40 years, now the Torah has been given its entirety, and now we say Lo B'Shamayim Hi. But this is year two. The Torah is actually quite, yes, B'Shamayim, some of it. And therefore there's not yet the time to object or to block the notion that certain halachic conclusions or input will come from Shamayim. And indeed, the expression Lo B'Shamayim Hi is only found at the end of Devarim. It's such a bedrock legal principle. It's very interesting. It's only in Parshas Nitzavim. Moshe says, shortly before he passes away, Lo B'Shamayim Hi, as if to say, now we've received the whole thing. There's nothing left. that's the approach of Reuven and Margolius, that this principle is only activated after the time, or towards the end of the time of Moshe Rabbeinu. There are others who say that the reason why Lo B'Shamayim is not an impediment in this case is because halacha, a ruling from the Beis Din, is based on really on two types of input or two factors. Number one, there's knowledge of the case. And number two, there's halachic ruling as to a decision as to what the halacha should be in that case. If you don't know, if either is missing, you can't paskin. But the difference between them is sometimes knowledge of what goes into the case, it's not halachic knowledge, it's just factual knowledge. If there's a piece of meat and the person doesn't know if it's kosher or not kosher, there's halachas has how to deal with that. If he gets a message from heaven, things could change. That's not a halachic ruling, it's just telling him it came from a kosher butcher. I mean, most people can't really rely on that, but in principle it's true. And therefore it could be that here it's not an infraction, so to speak, of Lo B'Shamayim Hi for HaKadosh Baruch Hu to tell Moshe that he had full criminal intent, because the question of whether or not he had full criminal intent, that's not a halachic question, it's just a reality question. We don't know. Hasra'ah could tell us. We don't have Hasra'ah, so we don't know. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could tell you. And that's not, he's not interfering in the halachic process. He's interfering almost in the, he's contributing to the evidence gathering. That's a separate branch, perhaps not as off limits to the idea of Lo B'Shamayim. That's the approach which Reb Tzvi Yerushchayas takes in his Sefer Torah Sanavi. So that, there's quite a bit to say, and more to say, in fact, for the end of the Parsha. But I would like just to go back and discuss a matter which is nogea, certain lemaisa in a sense, because it relates to Sfiras HaOmer. We have the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer in our parsha, of course, in Perikav Gimel, Pazuk Psukim Tesvav, Tetzayin, etc. And I'd like to discuss a very well-known halacha, and then maybe mention one or two things about it which are not as well-known. The halacha states, this is in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Taf Pei Tesif Dalet. I think this is probably the best known, and for some reason, much beloved halacha about Sfiras HaOmer. In Seif Dalet, the source is the Abu Draham. Shulchan Aruch says, if one asks his friend what night it is of the Omer, already from the time that you could potentially fulfill the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, he says, Eze Yom HaYom of Sfiras HaOmer. Lo Yom HaLo. So you shouldn't say to him, Ayom Kach VeKach. Rather, he should tell him how much it was yesterday, even though if you have a pencil and paper, you should rapidly be able to work out the implications for today or for tonight. Nonetheless, because he didn't directly, explicitly say the night what it is tonight, he's okay. Why? Because, says the Shulchan Aruch, because if you tell him what night it is tonight, but you didn't make a bracha, so that's it. You've already counted, but that's not okay. Because you should count with a bracha. But Nebuch, you've just now fulfilled the mitzvah already, so you lost the bracha for that night. Therefore, better to tell him what it was last night. Now, there are a number of very interesting observations to make about, again, this well-known halacha. Firstly, we should know, the entire premise of the halacha seems to be at odds with the halacha as we know it, for the following reason. There is a question that runs throughout the Shas, which is called mitzvos tzrichos kavana, as if to say, what if a person performs the mitzvah, that is to say, he does something which could work as performance of a mitzvah, he just didn't have the intention to fulfill the mitzvah, but he really did do that thing. He picks up a lulav and esrog and shakes them around just because he wants to see how heavy they are or if they're the right size with each other, etc. Lamaisa, in physical terms, he has done what people do when they fulfill the mitzvah. He just didn't intend to fulfill the mitzvah. Has he fulfilled the mitzvah? Mitzvos tzrichos kavana, is intention to fulfill the mitzvah critical to the fulfillment of the mitzvah? Or perhaps is it not critical? It's obviously desirable. Is it critical? The Shulchan Aruch discusses this in Siman Samach, and the Shulchan Aruch says, it's critical. An act, a performance of a mitzvah done without the intention to fulfill the mitzvah does not fulfill the mitzvah. Now, if that's true, and that is the position of the Shulchan Aruch, so let's consider, when someone asks you, let's say, for example, it's the fourth night of the Omer, that's literally days away, it's a safe zone. If someone asks you, is it tonight the fourth? And you say, what night is it for the Omer? You say, tonight, the fourth night of the Omer. You didn't say so with the intention of fulfilling the mitzvah. You did so with the intention of answering his question so that he can fulfill the mitzvah. You're going to do it later on. So it was done without kavana, say, which means it shouldn't be a problem. You should not have forfeited the bracha. That is very simply the first question. The premise of the Avodram is, you've already fulfilled the mitzvah, but without the bracha. That's a shame you lost the bracha. You didn't fulfill the mitzvah because it was without intention. Well, many Mefarshim raises, Poskim raises question. The Mokan Avram says that perhaps the understanding is that as true as it is that in principle we say that mitzvahs need intent, but when it comes to the risking perhaps making a bracha unnecessarily, we factor in the possibility, the other opinion, that mitzvahs don't need kavanah. In other words, that if you go back and make a bracha when you already said it, that's something that we don't like to do. Even though, you know, at heart we say mitzvahs trichas kavanah, but we wouldn't have you make a bracha if the other side says that you've already been yoked to the mitzvah. So it's really in deference to the severity of a possible bracha levatala. That's what it's all about, says Magen Avraham. There is another possibility, though, on this question. And that is, it relates to a more basic question. What is the nature of the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer Bizman Hazeh, in our time? It's a mitzvah in the Torah, but is it a mitzvah in the Torah nowadays? What does that depend on? Well, very simply, the counting of the Omer, one could say, is linked to the bringing of the Omer. And if that's so, then the absence of the Korban Omer, perhaps there is no mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer. The alternative is to say they're two separate things. Of course, the time frame is the Korban Omer, but it's an independent mitzvah. Even if you don't bring the Omer, you still count the Omer on a Torah level. That is the question. Do we lay emphasis on the words Mimachras HaShabbos, on the calendar date? Or do we lay emphasis on the words Miyom HaViyachem Es Omer HaTnufa, which is about bringing the Omer? That is the question. Now, although it's a machlokas, and the Rambam famously is of the opinion that even now they say it's min haTorah, his opinion is not accepted lahalacha, as if to say, almost all poskim opine that Sfiras HaOmer nowadays is midrabanan. Well, if that's true, then perhaps that's why the issue of intent is a problem. Because there are those who are of the opinion, this is the Radvaz again, that the entire machlokus, whether mitzvahs need intent, critically or not, is with regards to mitzvahs d'oraisa, Torah mitzvahs. But a mitzvah d'rabbanon, all agree you can fulfill the mitzvah even without intent. If that's true, then because Sfiras HaOmer nowadays is d'rabbanon, you would be yotzei even without intent. That's why you'd lose your bracha. So these are issues of intent. But now I'd like to come closer, in a sense, to the furniture of the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer, exactly the stuff of which it's made. The classic formula, of, again, if it's the fourth day, is Hayom Arba'ah Yamim La'Omer, or Ba'Omer. Those four words. And now the question is, how many of those four words are actually critical to the mitzvah? What if you missed one out? Well, if you missed the number four out, clearly you have a problem. But what if, for example, if you said, you didn't say the word Ba'Omer, or La'Omer. You just said Hayom Arba'ah Yamim. Are you yotzei? We don't want to try it, but are you yotzei? So the halacha is, interestingly, and this is from the Rashba, you are yotzei, even if you didn't say la'omer. You're not sure whether you should say la'omer or ba'omer, and you couldn't decide, and you just didn't say anything. You just said hayom abar yamim, you're yotzei the mitzvah. The word la'omer is not critical. But interestingly, the word hayom is critical. In other words, if you say, when you think about it, if you say, Arba Yamim La'Omer, that's because that's not a sentence. You can't just say 4 days. What is what? When's 4 days? So the word Hayom is critical. Because the word Hayom is critical, says the Magen Avraham, if you don't say the word Hayom, you can say what day it is as long as you don't say today. Which means in your classic scenario, once again, someone says, what day are we today? And in the Omer, and you say four. That's okay, because you couldn't possibly be yotzei the mitzvah by saying four. You at the very least need to say today or 4 days. If you don't say those words today or 4 days, we're not worried about you accidentally being yotzei the mitzvah with words that you couldn't even be yotzei on purpose, even if you wanted to. And therefore, those who are slightly more in the halachic know would tell us that actually you don't need to tell them what day it was yesterday. You can say what day it is today. Just don't say today. How many days are we? 21. Mutter lechatchila. Okay. There is another point. And again, closer to the possibility. You see, as true as it is that there is an opinion that if you do a mitzvah without intent, you would be yotzei. There is that opinion. Mitzvahs ein shichus kavana. All agree, for our purposes, all agree that if you actively intend not to do the mitzvah, you certainly are yotzei. In other words, you can't fulfill a mitzvah against your will. If you do something that could have the performance of a mitzvah, but you do so with the direct intention, I do not wish to fulfill the mitzvah with what I'm doing now, you certainly will not be yotzei, according to all opinions. And therefore, say certain poskim, you could even say on the fourth day, today's the fourth day of the Omer, if you have in mind at the time, you're consciously thinking, I do not wish to be yotzei the mitzvah with what I'm saying. I'm just helping out my friend who doesn't know what day it is. In principle, that's true. But what's interesting is, with all of these things, they're so prone to mishap. We can very easily see why the Shulchan Aruch didn't recommend a course of action like that. So that's the prima goddard. So today you're thinking about it, tomorrow you won't think about it. That's normally what happens with tomorrows. In other words, on day four, you have the presence of mind to say, I actively do not wish to be out to the mitzvah. By day five and six, you forget about that, and then you're back into problems. And therefore, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't recommend these non-user-friendly things. The Shulchan Aruch has a certain sense of achrayus to the Jewish people. And therefore, he'll tell you to say yesterday, it's fail-safe. It's foolproof. If you start saying, well, you know, tell him the day, but don't say hayom, or say it with opposite intention, you're asking for trouble. Within a group of three people, two of them will get it wrong within half an hour. But there is a follow-on, which could have practical implications, and could potentially marginalize, one could say, this entire halacha. And it's quoted by the Mishnah Berurah. You see, what if you did something, you demonstrated that you don't wish to fulfill the halacha? There's something about what you said that demonstrates that you don't wish to fulfill the mitzvah, because you wouldn't want to do a mitzvah in this way. Now, if that sounds abstract, what does that mean? Says the Mishnah Berurah, this is quite a surprise if you've never heard it, and it may cut down this entire halacha into less than a seventh of its original size. And that is, after 7 days, the way that you count the Omer is to mention not only how many days you are, but also how many weeks you are. Now, once that's true, and there's a shaila, are you even yotzei if you didn't mention the weeks? Maybe you are, maybe you're not. If you're not, then once again, if you say today is 13 days, but you didn't say 1 day and six, 1 week and 6 days, you didn't say enough to be yotzei the mitzvah. However, says Mishnah Berurah, even if you would be yotzei, no one wants to be yotzei the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer after the seventh day by not mentioning how many weeks it is. Anyone who knows anything knows the way to fulfill the mitzvah. You say it's 13 days, which is Shem Shavua Echad, Bishisha. No one would feel good about themselves or their Omer counting if they just said it's 13 days. And because that's true, any day after 7 days where the correct way to fulfill the mitzvah is by mentioning the count in terms of weeks as well, weeks and days, if you just said the days, you've done it in a way that you wouldn't want to be yotzei the mitzvah, and therefore you're certainly not yotzei the mitzvah. And really what this means is, says Mishnah Berurah, is that according to this, this entire halacha of saying what day it was yesterday, it's only true for the first 6 days of the Omer. But from day 7 till day 49, you can actually say what day it is. which I don't think is so well known. Which means that we're way past that point. It's Torah Lishma for us. It's just to remember for 6 days next year. Interestingly, I asked someone this yesterday. I was in the Beit Knesset Agron by Vigan, Baruch Hashem, surrounded by Tamei Chachamim. I picked on one of them. And I asked him the following question, because if one takes this idea, which is such a fascinating idea, that in a sense, if you do the mitzvah in a way which clearly you wouldn't want to be yotze the mitzvah that way, so that's almost like you're establishing an intent not to be yotze, in which case you're not yotze, so you're safe. So I asked this Talmud Chacham, so then why is it ever an issue, even on the first 6 days? Isn't it true that the correct way to fulfill the mitzvah is Sfirsa Omer, to make a bracha first? Which means that the very fact that you didn't make a bracha, let that be the demonstration that you don't wish to be yotze the mitzvah now. Because if you wanted to be yotze the mitzvah, you'd make a bracha, which would actually reduce the entire halacha, by definition, into non-existence, which clearly isn't true. It's not so easy to understand why. Presumably, one would have to distinguish between the formula of the counting itself as opposed to something that accompanies it, which is easier said than understood, at least to me. But just another further point, which I think, again, just to follow up on these possibilities, it is certainly true, and everyone knows, that you stand when you count the Omer, and that may even be critical requirement. And everyone does it. So interestingly, what if you're sitting down when someone asks you what day of the Omer? That can happen, statistically. According to the Mishnah Berurah, there would be, again, no problem. Today is 3 days in the Omer. Oh, maybe you fulfilled the mitzvah. If I wanted to fulfill the mitzvah, I would have stood up. So, again, none of this will take away from it's hard to express it, but it's such a well-known halacha, and everyone likes it, and maybe just that and that's another element to Sfiras HaOmer. But as much as it's well-known, this halacha shouldn't be overknown. And by that I mean, without knowing all of the details, which, as we said, further and further, it's actually very hard to find a person who would forfeit the bracha. It needs to be the first 6 days. He needs to be standing up. He needs to say Hayom, and that being the case, sometimes we could lose out if we don't know the halacha completely. Because imagine a person in that scenario who didn't say Hayom, he said 22, and said, oh, I've lost the bracha. It's a shame. He didn't lose the bracha. He didn't say Hayom, it's already after 6 days, etc. So we don't want the halacha to be overknown, but rather to be understood for what it is. And having discussed the halacha a little bit, just to... amusing with regards to Sfiras HaOmer. It's a difficult mitzvah really to relate to, I think, because it's so simple. It can be actually a little bit unnerving. Over the period of 49 days, you just say what day it is every day. And it's not like most other mitzvahs where seemingly a bit more happens. So one's left almost like with a bit of a silence afterwards, which is possibly why that silence is filled in with the entire service that surrounds Sfiras HaOmer, including Kabbalistic invocations and everything else, because we're not sure what to do with just the mitzvah of Sfiras HaOmer itself. I mean, dyed in the wool Litvaks just count the Omer and say Harachaman. But the Sifrei in Parshas Ekev tells us that the Chacham and the Ksil, the wise person and the foolish person, they both enter the Beis HaMedrash, and when they do, they encounter the vastness of Torah. And the Ksil, the fool, he looks around and says, so much Torah, I don't have a chance. I mean, how am I going to do this? And he walks out. He's confronted with the vastness of Torah, he just can't see. So he doesn't ever start. So what does the Chacham do? He's also a beginner. He's a wise beginner. What does he say? There's so much Torah, I should get started. Some today, some tomorrow. Over time, I'll make inroads. So where's the wise person succeeded? Because he's understood that he doesn't have this notion that he has to do everything at once. He's not thinking in immediate terms. He's thinking in ongoing terms. He makes a plan. He's forward thinking. Sfiras HaOmer is an amazing mitzvah. It's so simple. But what is it? So it's possible that in a sense, we say it's preparing for receiving Torah because it's chinuch for receiving Torah. It's an amazing mitzvah. It's a mitzvah where you can't do the whole mitzvah in one day. You can't do it all at once. If a person wants to make a hidur and do all 49 at once, he hasn't done anything. You know from the outset you can't fulfill this mitzvah all at once. Not in one day. But you can't miss a day. It's made up of every day. And it gets it into our system. By the time we arrive at Harsina, all we've done is a simple counting process in a sense. But we've trained ourselves to understand there are certain things in life that are very important, crucially important, they can't be done in one day, but you can't miss a day. If that's been inculcated into our system, we're ready to receive the Torah, whereby, again, can't be done in one day. But that should serve to certainly give us an orientation whereby we will mitzvah Hashem, use all of our days, day by day, and make the emirates that we wish to. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Again, I mentioned we'll meet again, mitzvah Hashem, in 2 weeks' time.
Gentlemen, we have exam-